Morning, everyone. We're going to get started. Good morning, and welcome to our panel on growing the middle class in a technology-charged economy. My name is Chris Jones, and I'm Senior Vice President and Chief Planner here at Regional Plan Association. And we have a very exciting and knowledgeable group of speakers on our panel, and I'm going to be introducing them in just a minute. But the topics that we're going to discuss today, technological change, growing inequality, and a shrinking middle class, these are big, complicated issues. And global competition, demographics, labor supply, government regulations, all of these interact with technology to change productivity, income, and jobs. So the solutions that we need for these issues need to be multifaceted as well. And our panel is going to help us sort this out, but I'm going to start just by going through a few data points that I think will give us a sense of scale for the problem. Hey, Mandu, sorry. We need to advance the slides. This isn't clicker networking. Go ahead. Oops. Thank you. So this first point is that there's a tremendous amount of job creation and destruction that goes on all the time. This chart that we have here shows the number of jobs that are gained and lost in each year and the net number of jobs that change. So this bottom line that we have here, this is the net number of jobs that are added to or subtracted from the U.S. economy all the time. And this is the number that gets the headline when the unemployment rate and employment rates come out each month. But that number really disguises the amount of churn that's going on in the job market at all the time. So for example, just last year, we added a net of 2 million jobs to the U.S. economy. But that number is the result of creating 13 million new jobs that were added to the economy and 11 million jobs that disappeared. And the other thing which is interesting about this chart is that this isn't increasing. As a matter of fact, if you look at the last few periods of growth in the 90s and before the last recession, we're actually creating and destroying fewer jobs than we had previously. So whatever the digital revolution is doing, it's not accelerating the pace of job creation and job destruction. But next slide, please. But what is happening is that the share of middle-skilled jobs is shrinking, and it's been shrinking for decades. By this analysis, the number of middle-skilled jobs in 1983 was 59% of the U.S. workforce. And by 2012, that was down to 45%. So here's a big part of the reason for rising inequality right here. Next slide. So what jobs are most at risk looking into the future? Well, the Center for an Urban Future took the analysis that the McKinsey Global Insight Group did on how automation is affecting the workforce. They applied it to the New York City workforce. And what they found is that there are almost 500,000 jobs in New York City that could be eliminated today using existing technology. That doesn't mean these jobs are going to disappear tomorrow. That's going to depend on everything from, you know, the cost of labor to government policies to a number of other factors. But certainly these jobs are at risk of being lost, and they're concentrated in things like food preparation, data processing, driving, a lot of things which require routine physical or cognitive skills. But certainly there is a growing number of white-collar jobs, of both managerial and clerical jobs that are being affected by this as well. Next slide. So just zeroing in on one sector that's getting a lot of attention, the transportation sector, this is an industry that has provided a foothold in the middle class for decades. And there's some 300,000 people in the entire region who make their living from driving a truck or a bus or a taxi or some other type of motor vehicle. And a few years ago, we were thinking, hey, this might be a sector that can replace a lot of the manufacturing jobs that were being lost for people that don't have a college degree. But with what's happened with both transportation network companies like Uber and Lyft and automated vehicles in the future, we certainly can't count on this as a growing sector. And as a matter of fact, we have to look at what's going to happen to people in this sector. Again, how many of these jobs will still be here a decade from now has to do with everything from labor costs, how quickly autonomous vehicles are introduced and accepted, but certainly it's a sector that we want to keep an eye on. Next slide. And in our fourth regional plan, you know, we have a number of recommendations that we think address, you know, parts of this issue. There are recommendations in there for creating a range of occupations in locations where people have greater access to them, in downtowns, near transit, and older cities. There are recommendations for how to improve skills through things like, you know, regional school districts to give people greater access to education and partnerships with universities and hospitals, and also some recommendations for how to invest in digital infrastructure and closing the digital divide. And I'm not going to go into those here, but I encourage you to look at the plan as a whole and look at these in greater detail. But our panel will take us, hopefully, with some new ideas and insights into this, and it will be moderated by Winston Fisher, who, besides being a partner for a leading development and investment firm, is the chair of New York City's Regional Economic Development Council, and is a board member of several leading civic organizations, including the Center for an Urban Future, the Citizens Budget Commission, and Regional Plan Association. Rob Atkinson is one of the nation's leading thinkers on technology, innovation, and the economy. He now leads the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation and has long been an advisor to national, state, and local governments and helped RPA understand the impact of information technology for a third plan back in the 1990s. Aisha Glover is president and CEO of the Newark Community Economic Development Corporation, where she oversees a range of innovative and community-focused economic development initiatives for New Jersey's largest city. Prior to her tenure with Newark, she was vice president for external affairs at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Bahravi Desai is the co-founder and executive director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, a 19,000-member union that is on the front lines of one of our most rapidly changing industries. Her members come from over 90 countries, and the alliance was the first AFL-CIO affiliate representing independent contractors. Pablo Ilanes is a partner at McKinsey & Company and a leader of McKinsey's Future of Work Special Initiative, which is developing new research, tools, and solutions to help organizations and regions deal with the significant talent and social disruption that may be brought on by new automation and digital technologies. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to Winston.
Great. Thank you, Chris. And thank you all for being here today. I'm excited to be moderating this panel. So technology is affecting a wide range of industries and workers, and it's presenting enormous challenges, but it's also presenting enormous opportunities. Everything from automation to supply chain distribution, local 3D fulfillment, real estate hoteling and remote working, these are just a few examples of what we're talking about when we say technology is disrupting and changing the nature of our workforce. We've all heard the story about truck drivers and Uber drivers being automated out of existence, but I haven't heard people talking about the fact that we're not far off from automating teachers as well. By 2027, AI will be enhancing and/or replacing our teachers. I'm willing to bet in 10 years, everyone in this room is going to be talking to a robot for stock advice versus their current stockbroker. From a business perspective, I wonder every day about how automation and technology are going to disrupt the real estate industry long term. Clearly, we see the impact in retail, what's happening with commercial space, obviously, the rise of industrial, et cetera. So with the effects of automation reaching more and more industries, we need to have an honest and open conversation about how we move forward to ensure everyone has a place in the new economy. New York City and the country need to rethink workforce development programs. We need to create an ecosystem where everyone, government, academia, the private sector, work collaboratively to prepare for the new economy, to prepare the workers and students. It's ironic, actually, that in the information age, one of the biggest problems we have is lack of communication and process between these three pillars. Education and workforce development need to evolve with the times, but it is not keeping up. We have the technology to identify workforce trends and predict the skills gap. We know how to build a new curriculum to train for jobs of tomorrow on a regular basis. We need the three pillars to working together to prepare a new generation for the 21st century job landscape. Gone are the times when a high school diploma guaranteed a good-paying middle-class job. gone are the times when people can expect to work for the same company for four decades and their retirement is taken care of. So therefore, we also need to rethink the new social safety net in the information age, which includes reimagining how we think about healthcare benefits, retirement funds, and other portable benefits. So while we're talking about the challenges to the workforce created by technology, we should also be thinking about how we use technology to be part of the solution. It is a scary, but it is also a very exciting time for the worker and for our economy moving forward. And so with that, we have four distinguished panelists here today who are leading experts in their field. I look forward to hearing their thoughts. I encourage a robust conversation, which I know we'll have. And this is probably one of the most important topics we can be discussing about how technology and the middle class economy are going to work together. So with that, I'd like to get into it. Start with Rob. You've been looking at how technology and innovation has been changing the American economy over several economic cycles. The problem of shrinking middle income jobs has been with us for decades. What's different about the period we're in now? Is the pace of change accelerating or affecting different types of work? And what is most important for government, business, and labor leaders to think about in addressing this challenge?
Sure. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today. We've been looking at this question at ITIF for probably 5 years now, and have written extensively on it, most recently a report that we were asked to write for the G7 ministerial in Montreal about a month ago, which is right on our homepage, itif.org. It goes through pretty much most of the literature and then what we ought to be doing about it. I think one of the big mythologies that's out there is that the pace of change is accelerating. Chris sort of alluded to that, but we have the lowest rate of risk. You now, in the United States, you meaning us, we face the lowest rate risk of losing our job from a downsizing or a closure in the last 25 years. We have the slowest rate of productivity growth probably since the Republic was formed, but certainly since we started measuring it in 1947. These are not indicators of technological speed up, they're indicators of technological stagnation. The reason we haven't raised wages, the dominant reason, not the only reason, the dominant reason we haven't raised wages very much, although we have somewhat, is not because of inequality. The dominant reason is because we haven't raised productivity. And given the fact that we have this massive baby boom retirement coming up, unless we raise productivity, we're going to be in deep, deep, dire straits. So the question is, how do we do that? And there's this new wave of innovation that's emerging that holds the potential to raise productivity. Now, I see one of the big problems with this is the entire narrative is all based upon loss, lost jobs, hurt workers, dislocation. That really wasn't the attitude for the first 200 years or so of American history. The attitude was opportunity, progress, the future. How many of you, by the way, currently work on a farm? Anybody? Okay, thank you. Because at one point, about 55% of Americans worked on farms, and thank God we didn't say, you know what, we're going to tax the McCormick Reaper because it's going to put farmers out of business and out of work. We didn't do that, and thankfully we didn't, because now we all have a lot more money than we would if we were all working on a farm. So how should we then think about this? I think there's a couple of ways. One is that a lot of the apocalyptic stories we hear, particularly, I guarantee, just Google or Bing, just type in automation and jobs, and I guarantee the first story will include a reference to the Oxford University study by Frey and Osborne. 47% of U.S. jobs will be eliminated in 20 years. Okay, immediately we should all run and hide under our desks because that sounds like an apocalyptic scenario. First of all, if it were true, it would be about 3% productivity growth a year, which is what we had in the 60s when we had 4% unemployment. But more importantly, it's not true. The study was incredibly flawed, and if you look at, I think, three good studies, one of them ours, ITIF, but two of them, McKinsey study recently just came out, and the OECD study, the range of those numbers are not 47%, they're essentially between 10 and 22%. So this notion that this technology is all powerful, it's going to do everything, and none of us are safe, and it's going to happen super quickly, I just don't buy it, and I think the very good studies that have looked at this accurately suggest it's not. One of the key things I think that's going to happen with this revolution, or this transformation, or if you want to call it the new production revolution, which is going to happen with robotics and AI and autonomous systems and others, it's going to have differential impacts on the labor market. And the last wave of innovation and globalization, as Chris alluded to, was really hit the middle income jobs and middle skill jobs more than it did lower and upper. At least when you look at the data sets, which we've done the analysis on, where we've looked at the 700 BLS occupational categories and then looked, using a number of different measures, looked at the risk of those jobs being automated, what you find is actually very striking, that the correlation between wage levels and risk of automation is very high and very negative. So it's about 0.55 for those of you who know your correlation coefficients. That's pretty big. In other words, the lower the income of the job and the lower the skill levels of the job, the higher the risk of automation. Now, that can be good or bad. The bad news is low skill and low income workers have a harder time when they're laid off than middle skill workers. They have fewer networks to get back in the workforce. They tend to have fewer skills. They have less of a safety of a cushion. So that's bad. But the good news, I think we have to remember, why do we have so many bad jobs in the U.S.? Why are there so many low skill workers in the U.S.? Because we have a lot of low skill jobs. End of story. And if we automate a large share of those low-skilled jobs, by definition, that means that the occupational makeup of the economy will shift more towards middle and higher wage jobs. That's an unalloyed good, I would assert. We can talk about it. The challenge, I think, is how do you help those individuals who are now in a low-wage job move into middle-wage jobs or middle-skilled jobs? Part of the problem is that somebody, and I'll just wrap up, part of the problem is a little easier than we think because in the U.S. about 15 to 20% of workers in low-wage jobs are overqualified from an educational perspective. You know, the PhD driving the Uber is the iconic case of that. But there are a lot of workers who are overskilled. They should be able to move in. But I think what it means is that we really have to start now not fighting this technology. You know, the robot tax that Bill Gates proposed is like close to the dumbest idea in the world. But that's not to say we shouldn't do anything. We need a dramatic overhaul starting now of our educational and particularly adult training system and dislocation systems. One area to start, by the way, would be how we think about teaching students the kind of skills that they're going to need. I think increasingly what students are going to need are what my colleague David Moshella calls double deeps. So you're a machinist, and that's one. But you also need to know data and statistics, or you're a graphic artist, and you need to know Adobe Illustrator and all. How are we doing on that? Well, in the United States, 90% of kids in high school take geometry. Guess how many take statistics? 8. I'm going to assert right now in a radical statement that is completely backwards. If you have to pick one of those two things to thrive in the world going forward, it's not geometry, it's statistics, and we don't teach statistics. In California, there are more children taking pottery in high school than there are computer science students. Now, again, you're not supposed to say that because everybody loves pottery. My daughter's at an arts magnet school. She gets mad at me if I say that, but I'm sorry. We are doing our kids a disservice in high school by not teaching them computer science. So I think we can do a lot there. We also need to do a much better job of helping workers when they're laid off. The set of tools that are available to workers when they're laid off is abysmal. The supports we provide for American workers when they're laid off is abysmal. It doesn't matter almost which state you're in. And so we need to do a much better job of all those things. And I think that's really where our attention should focus on, not hand-wringing about this or trying to slow it down or doing universal basic income, but working now to put in place better policies and programs to help adaptation.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. A lot to think about. Let's go. Bayravi, your workforce is at the front line of the 21st century disruption. What programs do you think are important that will allow technology to thrive, but also protect or retrain your workers? How do you see industry transitioning to maximize job potential given modern technological changes including the likelihood that driverless cars will become more and more of a reality.
Thank you, Winston. Good morning, everybody. So before I answer that question directly, I'd like to kind of hit the pause button for a moment in the conversation, because, you know, I think it's really important to understand that it's not just about what happens when we get from point A to point Z. What really matters to me is what happens in between, right? The gig economy is what we call it, actually. You know, all of these companies like Uber and Lyft, you know, the platform economy, digital economy, they're propagating work, which at the heart of it is about the destruction of full-time jobs into and turning them into poverty pay gigs. I mean, across the country, you know, I'm sure you know, you all heard a few weeks ago, there's a lot of controversy because an MIT study was coming out that had been the most comprehensive study to date looking at driver incomes on the you know, Uber and Lyft platform, and found that drivers were averaging about $4 an hour. So, you know, Uber raised a lot of issues with it, had asked the study to be redone. When it was redone, working with the Uber economists, they still concluded that more than half of the drivers were under minimum wage. Uber itself has talked about the fact that over 50% of the drivers leave the company within a year. I mean, there is very high turnover. And you know, when Uber and Lyft first lobby for deregulation bills, they claim to offer jobs. Once they win the deregulation, they say these are not jobs, these are gigs. And that they're, you know, they're not an employer, they're just a platform. Well, you know, the thing is, for the people that I represent, there is a human cost to that type of a framing. And that human cost is really the proliferation of poverty. I mean, I think, you know, going back to the charts that, you know, Chris was displaying earlier, I mean, when we look at the stagnation in jobs, we also have to look at the stagnation in incomes. And, you know, income inequality is a real problem in this country. The fact that an average CEO will make 270 times more than the average worker. If you take that in the Uber context, for example, and you compare what the Uber CEO was promised, at least what's been reported in the business media in terms of pay and stock options and so forth, and you contrast that to average Uber driver earnings at even $35,000 a year, which is high because most earnings are reported to be much closer, you know, in the 20s. But even between $35,000 compared to the CEO rate, it's a difference. You know, the CEO makes 5,700 times more than the average driver. And in that difference that's where, you know, there's the failure of the reason there's no social net, right? There's no safety net. I mean, they're classified as independent contractors. Unemployment doesn't even come into play. So, you know, just the widespread part-timeization, the misclassification, the fact that this is a business model that really depends on underemployment, unemployment, and wage stagnation, I think is a significant problem, right? I mean, we can talk about the technology. Technological advances are necessary as part of human growth. We should not stand in that way. But what needs to be analyzed separately is the business model that is being ushered in an expedited fashion, with the claim that if you want the technological advances, you have to somehow accept the business model. Now, of course, in the context of automation, that's when it, you know, really becomes, you know, a zero-sum question. The assumption is, if there's automation, then, you know, requires a business model of complete joblessness. I would say the fact that the joblessness through automation at this historic juncture that we're looking at, the fact that it is mostly of low-wage workers, is really problematic. And it's not just low-wage workers. They're for workers who are already starting out with lesser options in the economy. There's already less of an economic foundation that people are standing on, and they're just one or two steps away from poverty. And poverty, you know, meaning homelessness and food scarcity, right? And lack of access to higher education. I mean, these are problematic human costs that particularly in the richest nation on earth, we need to have a more complex and humanistic, you know, conversation about. People should not have to live that way. That should not have to be the new economy that we build. We can have technology, but it should be technology that advances humanity, where we reduce poverty and inequality and not actually expedite that chasm. And so I would say, and I'm sorry, one more thing I want to add. It's a community of low-wage workers that are mostly people of color and immigrants. They're people that are further marginalized within our society. They're people who are already seen as expendable, you know, in a larger political sense. And so their expendability within the economy seems to, you know, become more acceptable, which I think is also part of the problem. We can talk about trainings, right? And, placing people into other aspects of the economy. There's no question that we need to build an economy that's not built on the proliferation of the low-wage sector. One thing I would argue is just because a job is low-skilled does not necessarily mean it's low-wage. And just because a job is low-wage does not necessarily mean that it's low-skilled. I actually believe that they can be two different concepts, that are motivated by kind of broader factors here. And so for us, really, it's been about what happens not just when and if automation comes in on such a large scale. It really is about what happens to workers and people and communities as we're on this path. How do we stop, you know, poverty from deepening within our city? New York State now has the highest income inequality in the country. And that has, I mean, you know, New York City recently in 4 months, we had suicides by 4 drivers, 2 livery drivers, a black car driver, and a yellow cab driver. The crisis, the economic crisis, the crisis of poverty, it's real. And if all people are hearing is about that automation is inevitable, that somehow technological advancement must require a business model that either puts people out of work or keeps them low paid, as the business model of today does, you know, there's a hopelessness that comes from that and a desperation, and there's a real human cost to that. And I don't think it's some sort of like an ignorant exaggeration on the minds of the poor. I think it's a real crisis that people every day are living through. And so the pause button, I think, is important because we don't just need to give people options once automation takes over. We need to show people how we can take them out of poverty today, put them on a different path today. And so, you know, when they're facing another level of joblessness, they're facing it from standing on a firm and solid ground and not going into it with a sense of desperation.
Thank you. I mean, so, what's clear, what I hear is obviously that the human cost of technology is something that cannot be ignored. And so it's why we're here, obviously, is the great question is, how do we have that progress? There's going to be a cost, but how do we have that progress and protect these people so that it's the disruption is manageable, so to speak, and the cost is manageable. Aisha, which is great to, I think, perfect to turn to you here, is Amazon's high-profile search has been in the news for months now. To attract Amazon and other large employers, you need to appeal to high-tech workers, which means ensuring quality public education for their children, housing that's affordable, housing that's affordable, and other services for your city that will make it attractive for a Fortune 100 company to settle there. So what are you doing in New York to be able to compete, and how do you make sure that Newark's existing residents benefit from the new jobs that are created?
Sure. Thank you, Winston, and I kind of feel privileged to follow both of the speakers who are kind of talking fundamentally about systems change. So it's a little more progressive and radical than I expected to be, but I feel at home, so thank you. So lots happening in the city of Newark. I do appreciate the added attention because of us being shortlisted for Amazon HQ2, but I have to say kind of just the work that's been underway, the renaissance that's been underway, has certainly teed us up for this moment, but has, you know, attracted corporations over the last several years. It's caused Prudential to reinvest in the city. They've been there for 140 years, but made a commitment to keep their headquarters there 10 years ago. And just, you know, being able to attract M&Ms, being able to attract Broadridge Tech, the country's largest fintech firm. So I just kind of wanted to give a little bit of context for the growth that's underway in the city. Is not necessarily surprising to us that we ended up on the list. But I guess also I wanted to kind of point out we're no longer at a place necessarily where we feel like we have to prove ourselves and say, here are our assets. You heard the governor speak earlier about education, about quality of life, about accessibility, our location. All of those kind of attributes are really fundamentally what we sold in our proposal and what we talked about to Amazon, but what we just generally say to attract corporations. But I think really at the core of that is how, to your point, how are we able to attract and retain talent? And so it's a combination of both of those two, right? We want to make sure that we're leveraging our location, 18 minutes only to New York City.
It's close.
And if you look at the RFP that Amazon released, really a lot of what they what was released in September, really what they laid out a lot was around accessibility, around location, major airports, transit-oriented development, and so that is, in many respects, Newark. And so our location, really being able to attract talent, but then growing talent from within is really critical and really at the core of a lot of the work that we're doing. And so there are a few major initiatives underway, Hire by Live, that's to hire local, a challenge and a kind of agreement with the corporate community to hire 2,020 residents by the year 2020. Buying local, that means incentivizing and encouraging the corporate community to buy and procure their services locally from small business owners based in the city of Newark. And then encouraging their workforce to also live locally. We know the added value that that comes with when people live and work in the same city. Right now, only roughly about 18% of Newark's workforce lives in the city. And so, you know, how do we make sure that folks are connected to the jobs that are already here and that are coming here? So that initiative is kind of branded by the mayor, but quite frankly, has been driven by the corporate community in the city. Prudential, again, really at the helm of that. And so having them make those specific commitments for specific jobs that they would make available has been critical. Also, making sure that that's combined with real and substantive training programs, right? One of the things that I had the privilege of being involved in while I was at the Brooklyn Navy Yard was its employment center. And so using that model of employer-centered and employer-driven workforce development programs are critical, right? So you're not essentially training for training's sake, and you're not looking at it from a workforce development organization's perspective, but you're looking at it more from the corporate perspective, and you're therefore able to align exactly what some of the jobs are going to be and the skill sets that are going to need to be with that. Newark is a college town. Oftentimes folks don't think about that. We're the fifth largest college town on the East Coast. So tapping into all of the talent that's coming out of the universities and having really strong partnerships with the universities there, NJIT, Rutgers. NJIT does graduate more graduates than MIT in a given year. Seton Hall, Berkeley, there's a great cluster. But then even looking beyond the city and trying to connect and make some really substantive partnerships with the universities there is critical. Rutgers is kind of at the forefront of this, leading a statewide initiative to engage universities in a more collaborative manner. And then I think one sector that we sometimes oftentimes overlook, particularly as it relates to tech, is logistics. And you know, having the second largest port in the country, right in the city of Newark, leveraging that, coming up with training programs geared specifically to that sector has been critical. And then an extension of that, really in the manufacturing space, NJIT has been leading a lot in this regard. Again, employer-driven training with certifications that are preparing existing residents for those jobs. So a lot of innovation, but I think one thing that makes the city of Newark pretty unique and different is that the corporate community is actually its own community. There aren't, they're not separate. And I can say this as a Brooklyn girl, because I've, you know, had my career, based my career in New York City. A lot of the corporations in New York City are kind of off on their own. The corporate community really truly comes together in the city of Newark. There's an entity called the Newark Alliance, and it's essentially a round table of all the anchors in the city. And so when you have the employers kind of informing training needs and hiring needs, essentially what you're doing is creating a very strong pipeline, and within that alliance also incorporating the universities. It is pretty unique, and it's hard to explain unless you're part of it. So Broadridge Technology is now commenting on it, like they had never experienced anything like that before. Maybe it's slightly cult-like, but we appreciate that. And what it does is it affords an opportunity to really come up with programs and initiatives that are directly impacting local residents and the local economy. I think corporations, because of Newark's branding, let's call a spade, corporations understand the value of what it means to directly impact the local economy, right? And so that's only going to inform or help their own branding. It's also going to support their ability to attract talent. And so it doesn't take much effort to kind of convince them, because they're at the table in a different way and really supporting a lot of the work that is underway through the mayor's office.
That's great. Thank you. I mean, it's interesting to hear how you talked about, you know, employer-driven workforce development. I've seen that in other places in New York, and it is a very powerful tool for job training and clearly the communication. Excellent. And last but not least, Pablo, for this first question, is growing the middle class in a tech economy is a challenge, not just for the New York City region, but for the country as a whole. Can you talk a little bit about what other states are doing in this space and what we can learn from their efforts in this region?
I can, but I'm not sure. Oh, it is working. Okay, the light wasn't going on. Okay. So I think this is a top issue across states. If you look at especially those states that are going through governor elections, and you look at both the platforms that are out there and the discussions and the debates, I would say it's a top three issue in most states right now. I think the second thing is no one really knows how to do this well. This is something, it's a concern of lots of people, but everyone's trying to build their own solution and approach to this at the same time. And the third point is, I think, echoing Winston, a comment you made before, that this is, I think, gonna have to really be a tri-sector sort of problem or solution. And the states and the cities that are thinking about this, I think, just as Aisha mentioned, are bringing together the public sector, the private sector, and the nonprofit social sector in creative ways. On this first point, I think, how do you get the private sector involved to not just be a source of demand for jobs, but actually a participant? I think Aisha gave a good example of some of the things that Newark is doing. But large private sector companies are terrified about these issues. You know, they're worrying about these issues. And so I think the challenge is, how do you get that to be a series of conversations that aren't happening in individual boardrooms, and have them, that dialogue happen in a different way? Can you get sectors to talk together? Can you get the private sector to share information with the social sector and the public sector to come up with joint solutions? Beyond example, I think of Newark. In D.C., for example, the Greater Washington Partnership. They brought together the largest companies in the region. The CEOs have come together, and they're coming up with a joint plan on digital jobs, and they'll be announcing some initiatives. In Connecticut, you have both the insurance sector and advanced manufacturing coming together separately, saying, what are we going to do about the talent issues that we have? Jointly sharing data, saying what the concerns are. And in that case, they've come together with all of the university presidents to have the discussion. And it's not just the four-year schools, it's also the community colleges. I think a second big trend that we see, and I guess I would call none of these best practices, is we just need better data. We need better data because without better data, we're not going to make better decisions. And a bunch of states are thinking creatively of how do you deploy technology in interesting ways to figure out what this problem looks like. So some of the trends that Rob talks about, what does this look like for my city or for my state? What we need better data on is for an individual student or worker, he or she's deciding what's the career I should go for, who's the vendor, who's the instructor I should work with. Right now, that decision is not often made based on facts, and it's a very tough one. Universities and vocational technical schools, what are the jobs we should be teaching? Who are the teachers that are doing a better job? What are the programs that actually have a better ROI? And on the private sector, they're asking the questions of what are the jobs and skills that I need? If they're not in my company today, which is going to be the Anson offer, do I reskill my current workforce? Do I go hire and attract new people? And where do I go find those people? And on the government side, spending millions of dollars on workforce programs, not sure really what the ROI is and which programs are better. And so government's trying to figure out what are the better programs I should be funding. Some examples of this, I would say, in California, they've launched both a launch board, which is a tech platform for educators. What are the skills that you should be training given what the demand is of the corporate and the jobs that are going forward? So it helps them gain transparency into kind of the HR office of companies. They have another platform called Career Surfer. That's for students. That's as you are thinking about what are skills that you should try to acquire and jobs you should try to acquire, give you some transparency into what do those pathways look like? What are the skills that you need? Who are the universities or trainers that you should work with? And accurate information on what are you going to earn? So how much should you spend? Are you making the right sort of decisions? Virginia took a very different approach. Virginia has said is creating a pretty unique conglomeration of data that's going to be open source. And so they realize that a lot of this data exists. It's hidden. It's hard to get to. And so they're creating sort of a shared platform. The data will be there, and the expectation is that nonprofits, private sector, and the universities will mine that in different ways. And other states are partnering. I think you have Colorado, for example, with LinkedIn. You have Florida with Burning Glass. I think you see Burning Glass doing lots of work with lots of different states. But individual states and cities are saying, we can't do this alone. Who is that tech or data provider that's going to come in and help us? So I think you see a lot of movement there. And quite frankly, we still have a lot more to be done. I think Winston made this point about educators, and of course, if the private sector often is sort of the demand for jobs, this doesn't work if education is just seen as sort of the supply of the talent. They need to be accountable, they need to be brought into this, and they need to be part of that. I think it's K-12, but it's also community colleges, technical schools, and universities. I was just looking in the last 2 weeks, Purdue, Delaware, Harvard, MIT, Miami, Georgetown all launched sort of think centers or think tanks thinking on this. We need more than that too, right? So it's not just thinking and doing some of the stuff that Rob and others do, but actually how do you start working this? Of course, SUNY and CUNY come to mind here in New York, but one thing that New York has is more university, community college students than anywhere else in the world, an incredible wealth of universities and tech providers. So one question is how does that community sort of come together and partner? And then fourth, I think this is this point of transition. I think the transition is the challenge right here. Regardless, I think we can all have a different view of what point Z looks like. We know that there's going to be some transition in the short term, and certain populations are going to be hit harder. I think the good thing is that there is a creative, growing nonprofit and philanthropic space here, and how do you work with them? So you have a bunch of national nonprofits that are appearing a lot here. You have Opportunity at Work, Hope Street, Skillful. They're doing things. Of course, here in New York, we have many more. How should you work with them to kind of experiment and figure some of these things out? And on the Pure Foundation side, you have the Markle Foundation, you have Chan Zuckerberg, you have Rockefeller, all have announced sort of large grants just in the last month. On the corporate side, Walmart, Google, just this week, they just announced another series. I think many of the corporate foundations are going to be making investments in this space. So it's just a point to say that I think one of the things that makes New York, particularly New York City, but the entire region, you have an amazing collection of private sector, nonprofits, a lot of philanthropy, a lot of foundation space, and then a lot of jobs and people. So it's quite urgent. And so I think one thing would be exciting is how do those three sectors start coming together so that other states look to us as an example?
Great. I mean, it's all of you, it's interesting you come at it from a different perspective, obviously, talking about whether data, the human cost, fascinating to see what Newark's doing, and obviously even having a perspective on what does it mean for technology and what and how scared we should be and how we embrace it. I think that leads to an interesting question, which is Bill Gates, and you just talked about this before, Rob, but Bill Gates has suggested that we tax companies that automate to capture some of that value of lost income to fund, he hasn't been exactly clear, but whether retraining programs, other programs, whatever it is. So do companies that are automating, do they have a responsibility to help people who are negatively affected, and should they be paying for some of that? And I put that, you know, Robin, I'd like you maybe to start, but clearly I think everybody will have something to say on this.
No. They're already doing us a great favor by automating. We have to remember that. How many people want to pay more for your goods and services? I'm being a little flip. What companies have a responsibility for, first of all, the main responsibility companies have is to lobby state, local, and federal governments for better systems and programs. Most of this has to come from public sector leadership, from organizations like Newark. That's the main responsibility, is say, look, there's a problem, and we need government to be part of the solution. But to say, tax us every time we help you by raising productivity, that by definition will get us less productivity, which we desperately need. I think the other thing government companies need to do is they need to be high-performance work organizations. There's a report we released about 6 weeks ago in the U.S. Senate laying out a soup-to-nuts agenda of what we need to do in four big areas, education and skills before workers lose their job, income support while they're, when they're laid off, transition assistance, and then also regional and place-based help. And one of the programs we highlighted was a program in the UK, which I'm blanking on the name on now, but it's an award program that has enlisted hundreds of UK corporations who, if you follow these certain practices around high-performance work, like you train your workers and you do all these other practices, you're eligible to get this award. I think it's Better Employers Award, I think it might be named. But anyway, there's no reason we couldn't do that in the U.S. and give employers a real incentive to step up to the plate and do more. So I'm all for that, but I don't think we should impose penalties on companies who increase productivity.
I mean, Bay Review, I'd love to.
Rob and I have had this back and forth before. I would say yes. I mean, why should corporate America not take responsibility for the social fabric, you know, of our country? I mean, yes, you know, the jobs are provided by the companies, but workers are the ones who do that labor, and they have just as much to contribute for the productivity. Well, one of the reasons we have historic inequality is because there has been productivity. It just has not trickled down. You know, the wealth of that has just not trickled down to labor itself. And I think that part of the problem of the process that the stage of the transition that we are in right now is that besides, you know, joblessness and low wage work, I mean, these companies like Uber and Lyft and the platform companies have lobbied across the country, where in 21 states across the country, they have won deregulation of labor law. So if you are a worker, and no matter the level of control that the company engages over you, right, as long as that company is part of the platform economy, the worker is not entitled to labor, basic labor protections. They will not be considered an employee. The company can control all of your economic destiny. They can be the one to, you know, profit largely from your labor, but there is no responsibility to you in return. Now, this is a generations old, you know, age old bargain between corporations and workers, that workers give up a level of give up control, right? But in return, you get some basic protections like a wage floor and a safety net. And at the same time, you know, tax evasion has been a big part of the platform economy as well. And I think that has serious consequences on what's happening with our society today. It has consequences in schools being kept open, you know, in food banks and shelters for the homeless, you know, different social programs that get cut because we don't have enough tax revenue coming in. And you know, it would be fine and dandy if the answer was, but we don't need any of these things because we're building a better economy where we're fixing poverty, right? That is the real solution. But in the absence of that, you need revenue that's going to provide, you know, a safety net for people that are out there struggling, particularly if they're struggling as a result of, you know, a business model that again is predicated on unemployment, underemployment, and wage stagnation. I think these companies have a responsibility to bear to the larger society, to the larger workforce, not just to the workers who directly work for them and make them those profits.
Okay. Well, thank you. So maybe we'll go Pablo and actually Aisha. This will be good for both of you. The 20th century model says that you'll get your health care from your job. And again, you work in the same job or a series of a few different jobs where you have health care. But with the new labor market, people are going from job to job, right? The rise of the gig economy, freelance. How can we create a system where health care and other benefits are portable but are also economical for, obviously, government and corporations and people?
So I think we haven't figured it out, and there's a lot of models and experiments of how to do this. I think, you know, the current way of identifying capabilities is off. You know, this idea that a degree is the way and it's going to be this currency that signals what you can go do and the value that can have, I think, is antiquated and is going to change. And I think many areas are thinking about how do we think about credentials and the validating of skills as opposed to the validating of degrees as this really a mobile currency that helps you with that upward trajectory. I think there are lots of discussions of with the growth of a gig economy, what does that do? I think some states are exploring different things, but there is no real answer yet, or at least no one model that's emerging, but I think it's a concern of many. If you're young, you cannot assume that you're gonna have that same job for the next 30, 40 years with the pension that comes with it and the security that does. So I think that's asking lots of people to ask lots of questions, but I don't have the answers.
Maybe
Aisha does.
So I punted to you because I was hoping you'd have the answer, and then I'd agree with you.
Right.
So I think one thing that's important to note is not just from the worker's perspective, but from the employer and small businesses' perspective. So we hear frequently from manufacturers and small businesses wanting to, you know, kind of pool benefits of some sort, right? So from the individual's perspective, if something was portable, but then for small businesses as well,
very
right?
Much.
And so because they are the backbone of the economy, I would be very interested in seeing a solution that addresses it from both the small business side and the workforce side. I don't have the answer either, but I think there's certainly a moment for disruption here that can address the needs because there's both a supply and a demand.
Right, I mean, fascinating because it is interesting. I can tell you as a medium-sized business, you actually wish you could pull resources, and that is an interesting perspective. So one thing that there seems to be a theme, we've heard about data, heard about workforce, we're hearing about, but is the education system. Workforce training, education. And so it's not a great statement that we need, or profound, that we need to change it. But so what do we change? What's the bold idea? How are we going to have a thriving middle class? What do we need to do in education to ensure they can have a good life? And let's, I think we can go down the line here. Rob?
Well, I think it's really not a question of what to do. It's a question of why aren't we doing it? So if you want to look and see who's doing it the best, you just look at what Singapore has done, which we wrote extensively about. If you talk to people sort of in this space, anybody who sort of follows this globally will say Singapore is the best in the world. They've put in place an array of policies. For example, they have a whole set of workforce training vouchers, particularly for low-income workers. They have a program where they have identified sectors and they've brought together all the employers in each sector around skill development. They've developed probably the most advanced technology tools to help workers assess their skills, find the skills they need, and then link up with training programs. We could, for example, transform American high schools if we wanted to with much more project-based learning, much more science and math high schools like Bronx Academy, I think, Brooklyn Tech. And we could do that if we wanted to. We could deal with the problem that 32% of college seniors in the United States are fully numerate. Think about that for a minute. According to the Educational Testing Service, that means that 68% are not fully numerate. 40% are fully literate. So we have a serious problem in higher education where a lot of kids are getting through that system and they're not learning enough to be able to go out in the labor market. That's a reformable problem, but we don't want to reform it because we don't want to deal with the tough political questions that have to get done. So I think this is much, much more a political question, right, and it's about institutional innovation. We all know what to do. If you study this, it's clear what programs work. It's partly about money also, by the way, which, you know, if you look at the U.S. and how much we invest in active labor market support systems, we're about half of what we used to do, and we're probably a quarter at best of what the world leaders are investing in.
Fascinating, please.
So I guess I would add that as important as it is to support project-based learning, we see Vo-Tech schools being tremendously successful. We see national rankings of high schools across the country, and we know who's always ending up on top. And yet those are the schools that fill the quickest, right? And those are the programs that are hardest to get into, right? And so fundamentally there's something wrong there. I consider my children to be quite bright. And the fact that they had difficulty getting in and ultimately didn't get in, and there are tons of other students just like them, there's something wrong about the level of access when there are quality programs. And so addressing that equity, obviously I don't have an answer for that, but what works in those programs is really supporting innovation. And oftentimes those programs have additional resources. To Rob's point, it's a political question, it's a budget question. We know what works, we've seen what works on the education side. For workforce development, I think in addition to funding, of course, there's fundamentally we have to make a decision, I think, about the paths that we're choosing, right? And so are we trying to make sure that students are college ready or career ready? We've taken a tremendous shift and hyper-focused around college when there are valuable vocational training and tech training programs that we've disinvested in, that we've underinvested in, that we leave nonprofits off on their own to kind of figure out the fundraising for. And so back to your earlier question of kind of a penalty for corporations, I don't know if I would say yes or no, but if we can think about a structure that is a fund or of some sort that can continue to make sure that these programs are successful and well-funded, so that way it doesn't become this cannibalization between all the nonprofits fighting for the same funding, hoping that, you know, their 15 or 20 or 30 people that are trained then get placed. I think if we really truly want to disrupt the system, we have to think about how to make sure that it's sustainable.
Very good. Thank you.
Well, I really agree with everything that's been said in terms of, you know, kind of the education from, you know, early childhood into, you know, college level. I would just want to focus on workforce development, right? Because that's where we're positioned. That we really have to have more investment in programs that are dedicated to, you know, training specifically for people that are already in, you know, already in the working world. And there are programs that actually just, you know, focus on blue-collar workers or workers in, you know, low-wage sector. We used to have a computer class at 1 in the morning for night drivers. And, you know, from like 1 to 4 in the morning, the place would be packed. And what's really interesting is it was for people came for a variety of reasons. Some folks came because they did want to see if they could ultimately look for work, you know, in a different field. Some folks were just older drivers who wanted to know how they could keep up with communication with their kids on, you know, on via email, right? And so it's hard for, you know, once you're working, and especially if you have a blue collar job, is the level of physical fatigue. It's, you know, pretty grueling work. We do need to find creative ways. We've looked into, for example, setting up computer kiosks for drivers at the airport taxi lot. We engage in a lot of education around language skills, you know, English writing language skills and writing proficiency. And I think it's important not just so workers have another means of entry into other work, but also so that they can play a more active role in civil society, which, you know, I think when you don't have access to certain means, you're more likely to be cut off from. Just really quickly, I just going back to your earlier question for a moment, I wanted to just very quickly say, we worked on a program, the Taxi Workers Alliance, where we had, you know, championed regulation at the local level to set up a portable benefits fund. Would have been the first of its kind in the country for independent contractors, you know, for taxi drivers, over 30,000 drivers. And we pulled the money together where we took a percent, 6 cents from every fare that was used to generate $10 million to, you know, have a group fund. Very long story, didn't come to fruition, lots of politics involved, but there are really innovative, I think, ideas like that of people trying to pool their resources, right, to lift themselves out of poverty and to, you know, create social safety nets again.
Great, thank you. Pablo?
Maybe just agree with everything that it said, just a framing point. For me, it's these are three very different problems that we sometimes mix together. I think there's a huge percentage of people which in the next five to two, they have jobs today, in the next 5 to 10 years, their job will be disrupted. What do we do with that group of people? So this is a reskilling challenge, it is a workforce development challenge, we can kind of identify what those populations are and where they are and what those jobs are. Second, it is, we know going forward, this is going to happen again and again and again. So how do we, as a society, as a region, think about sort of this, it's cliched, but this ongoing continuous learning? We know that there's going to have to be more adult learning in the future. We know that you're going to have to get retrained when you're 30, when you're 40, and you're 50 going on. We don't have a system that does that very well, even if you have a very good job within a company, right? We don't have that. And then the third is, if you're solving those two, the pool is the same size if you don't fix the pipeline, right? For every bucket that you fix, you're not addressing some of the issues. And so then we need to be tackling the pipeline, which is, it's you can, whatever, however you want to cut it up, if it's elementary, middle school, and high school, but that pipeline also needs to be fixed. And then the challenge is you've got to somehow connect all three of those things. And often when we have these discussions, everyone talks about everything or about just one of those, but I think those are three very different problems that require different approaches.
Good. Thank you. All right, well, so we have about 15 minutes left, and I think it's a good time to go to audience questions. So we'll start off, first question. How do you build a consensus on workforce needs in a tech automation environment when key political voices says the pre-automation economy can be preserved? So I think that's a, why don't we start with Bayravi? How do you answer that question?
I think what would be important to look at, right, is the voices that would be critical, like, you know, voices like ours in where, you know, people like us who kind of believe automation, mass automation doesn't have to be inevitable. The conversation that I think we're missing out on, I feel, you know, I think Pablo also alluded to that earlier, really is about what is happening to people in this moment, right? If in this moment, if there, you know, there are ways to address the deepening poverty and job insecurity that is in this moment, I just think you bring people to a different point where they can envision the future, right? I think part of the block there is if you're talking to people who are facing, you know, poverty, like, you know, serious issues related to poverty, and then you expect them to engage in a conversation about a topic which they can only relate to being further impoverishment, because at the end of the day, it means they're gonna have no job at all. It's very hard to engage the imagination from that position, right? So I really do think addressing the issues of, you know, poverty and low pay in the immediate moment, I actually think would allow us as a society to have a fuller conversation about reimagining the future where it can have these different possibilities in it. When people feel a greater sense of security about their present, it changes the way that they think about their future.
That's great. Aisha, what's your perspective on the what a consensus on the workforce needs are?
I guess I'm struggling with this question because the consensus has to, when we were working on workforce development in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, we were trying to cluster together some of the businesses there to make sure that the training was consistent with it by cluster, right? So they would all have to come up with or agree upon, yes, we're gonna need workers in X, right? A certain number of CNC machine operators, this group needs whatever. And so I think engaging the employers to identify the consistencies within the sector where they have the ability to articulate, here's what we need, I think is critical, right? And so making sure that that is coming from them and not us assuming, okay, here's what we're going to design, and hopefully that's gonna align with, you know, and help create more SDEs, and that's gonna help address some of your needs in this area. So I think making sure, again, that it's employer informed and that they're speaking directly to, we tend to kind of bucket everything in tech together as if this one program in tech is now going to help someone get a job at Audible, at Broadridge, at Gadget, when it's not that simple. So I think that engagement is key.
Please, Rob.
So I was talking to a Swedish labor union leader a couple of years ago, and I asked him about this question, and he said, because in Sweden, the labor union doesn't fear new technology. We fear old technology. The worst thing that can happen to the labor movement in Sweden is the employers aren't at the cutting edge of adopting technology, because then we know that rather than lose 10% of the jobs, we're going to lose 100% in 5 years. Why do the Swedes have that view? They have that view because losing your job in Sweden isn't all that painful. There are incredible systems in place, what they call flex security, where they embrace flexibility, but they also then provide a lot of tools. And I think that's really this political solution to this. A lot of Democrats look at this and progressives and say, we have a deep sympathy for workers, which is correct, but they translate that into saying, we can't ever let a worker ever lose their job. And that cannot work. And so the answer for progressives, I think, and Democrats, both realistically and politically, is to adopt flex security. For Republicans, they generally are maybe more pro-growth, but more free market. What I think they need to understand is if they don't step up and say, we support these kind of systems in the U.S. that are going to require more government and more public-private partnerships, that essentially people are going to become Luddites. They're going to become fearful. They're going to push back at companies and policies that lead to this kind of thing. And that's not something most Republicans want either. So I think there is a third way, talking about a group that you're involved in,
yes.
A third way consensus around this that both parties should be able to embrace.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, clearly there's the answer here is not black or white. And I hear that from everybody is that, actually I will say what's encouraging is there are answers. It's really about the change, the ability to change, not what should we change. But that's a good question. That leads into, so for Pablo, so what other skills besides stats and computer sciences should we be teaching our students for them to participate in this new economy?
So I don't think it's just our students. I think it's all of us. And again, I hate the jargon of, you know, soft skills, but so many of the programs we have right now on these tech pipelines, right? And we're teaching people how to do certain things on the tech side because we see these jobs growth. Unfortunately, those are also the jobs that are going to get automated, right? So we're investing a lot of money in these areas where jobs, if we run the numbers, we're not sure they're really there in 20 years. All of the numbers suggest that, you know, these valuable things to be able to kind of the plasticity to relearn is huge. The ability to show empathy, to be able to run in meetings, to be able to kind of have that interaction, the social interaction, these are things that are critically important, just as, well, I would actually say the statistics may be even more, but beyond that, you need these skills. I think the challenge with these skills are two. We're not good at teaching them, and we're not good at evaluating them. I mean, one of the reasons why we have so many code programs is because I can, in 5 minutes, know if you have learned it or not, because I can really test for it. Some of these other things, we haven't actually figured out how to do the testing. And I think there you actually see a lot of innovation right here, both from educators and tech companies. Is there a better way for us both to teach, but also evaluate some of this soft skill toolkit, which we know will be more important? And I think it came up in, I think, the second slide that we used when we kicked off.
That's great. Well, listen, thank you very much. This has been, we're going to wrap up. This has been an incredible panel. Honestly, all of your insights were frankly very valuable, and I hope everybody took something from it. And I do want to say that, again, there are solutions to this problem. You heard that here. Everybody here talked about the ways we can do things different. Reminds me of the old joke, we only need to change one thing, you know, everything. But there is an answer for how the middle class can thrive in the 21st century. That's not the problem. It's, do we have the will to implement these changes? Can we restructure our education system, the way we deliver benefits, the way we think about public-private sector interaction? And if we can do that, I actually see a very bright future for workers and for our economy and for America. So thank you very much. This was incredible. Thank you.